Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 23.
And today we're jumping into the amazing world of Journey to the West, specifically Chapter 23.
That's the one beautifully titled Tripitaka Not Forgetting His Origin and the Four Saints Test the Mind of Zen.
Right.
And it's, well, it's more than just another adventure.
Okay.
The chapter itself kind of tells you up front. It says this part covers how the Tao of the Journey to the West isn't really separate from the Tao of cultivating one's own nature.
Ah, so the outer journey reflects the inner one. Yeah, makes sense.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The physical trek is like a mirror for their spiritual growth. So let's get to our main characters. We have Tripitaka, our unwavering and devout monk, and his three very well distinctive disciples. The ever energetic Monkey King.
Yeah.
So, the perpetually hungry and often lustful Pigsy. And the steadfast, if quieter, Sandy.
Quite the crew.
As evening approaches, we immediately encounter some familiar friction.
So, finding a place to crash for the night, Tripitaka's worried about lodging.
He usually is. But Sun Wukong's reply, it's pure Wukong.
What does he say?
He basically says, Master, you're thinking about it wrong. We monks, we eat the wind, sleep by the water, under the moon, on the frost, everywhere is home. Total detachment.
Mm. Easy for him to say, maybe. But yeah, shows his mindset. Very different from, well, from Pigsy.
Oh, Pigsy. He immediately starts complaining. It's so, so human.
What's his beef this time?
He's like, brother, you only know how easy you have it walking. What about us carrying all this stuff? Ever since the Flowing Sands River, it's been mountains, ridges, heavy loads. It's extremely hard to bear.
Classic Pigsy. Always focus on the creature comforts. Or lack thereof. He really grounds the story, doesn't he? Reminds you it's not all abstract philosophy.
Definitely. He's that part of us that just wants things to be easier. But Sun Wukong, he jumps right on him.
Yeah. What does he say?
Scolds him for his complaining heart. Tells him to endure hardship.
Yeah.
No sympathy there.
That constant tension, right? The ideal versus the reality.
Exactly. And this whole argument naturally leads to the actual burden. Pigsy gives this amazing description of the luggage.
Oh, yeah. Lay it on us.
Okay, she lists it out. 4 pieces of yellow rattan strips, 8 ropes, long and short. Got to guard against rain, so 3 or 4 layers of felt wraps.
Wow, specific.
Worried the carrying pole would slip, so nails hammered into both ends. A 9-ring staff with copper and iron bits, a big cape wrapped up with bamboo and rattan.
Yeah.
You can just picture it all piled up.
You really can. No wonder he's complaining. You can feel the weight.
And he's ticked off. He grumbles about doing all the hard labor while Wukong and Tripitaka get to ride. He feels like a hired hand, not a disciple.
That feeling of unfairness.
Yeah.
Very relatable. What's Wukong's comeback? Still tough.
Oh, yeah. Look, my job is looking after the master. You and Sandy, you handle the luggage and horse. Slack off even a little, he says, and you'll get a whack on the shins with my rough cudgel.
Ouch. Not exactly supportive management.
Huh. No. But this whole squabble actually leads somewhere really important. Pigsy, trying to lighten his load, suggests the horse could carry some stuff.
Okay. And this is where it gets interesting.
This is the big reveal. Sun Wukong says, you think that's just a horse. He's no ordinary horse. He's actually the third son of the Dragon King of the West Sea, Aoran. His name is Longma Third Prince.
Whoa, a dragon prince disguises their horse. That's unexpected.
Totally unexpected. Changes everything, doesn't it? Even powerful beings can end up in humble spots as part of their own journey. Challenges your assumptions.
So why is he a horse? What's the backstory?
Well, apparently he set fire to some precious pearls in the palace. Big trouble. Accused of being unfilial, breaking heavenly laws.
It's serious stuff.
Very. But Guanyin Bodhisattva stepped in, saved him. So being a horse is partly penance, partly his way of earning merit on this pilgrimage.
So she transformed him.
Yep. At a place called Eagle Sorrow Gorge. Took his scales, his horns, the pearl under his neck, turned him into the horse to carry Tripitaka west.
Wow. That's quite a fall from grace, but also a chance for redemption.
Exactly. Wukong stresses that this is the Dragon Prince's own, his meritorious deed. He warns Pigsy, basically, don't try to piggyback on his merit or take advantage.
Even Sandy pipes up, right? He's usually quiet.
Yeah, even he's like, brother, is he really a dragon? Just shows how extraordinary it is.
The Pigsy's still skeptical.
Oh, Pigsy knows dragons. He says dragons can spray clouds, stir up mist, kick up dust and sand. They can shake mountains, churn up the seas, you know, awesome power.
Right.
So he's confused. Why is this guy walking so slowly today? If he's so powerful, why the slow pace?
Good question. Leads to a Wukong moment, I bet.
Classic Wukong.
Yeah.
He just shakes his golden hooped rod. Boom. Thousands of colorful clouds appear instantly.
And the horse.
The horse freaks out. It recognizes Wukong's power. Remembers who's boss, basically. Afraid of getting hit, it just bolts.
Cool.
Faster than lightning.
Poor Tripitaka. He must have been hanging on for dear life.
Oh, completely. Nearly thrown off as this suddenly superpowered horse tears up the mountain path. It's funny, but it also shows that dragon power is still in there, just dormant.
Right, under the surface. So after that chaos, they finally arrive somewhere.
Yeah, they reach the top and see this, a big estate. Looks quite grand.
And the description sounds lovely, almost too perfect.
It really does. Cypress is by the gate near green mountains, pines swaying, bamboo clumps, wild chrysanthemums frosty, orchids by a bridge reflecting in water. Very picturesque.
Walls of powdered mud, brick enclosure, sounds well kept. Main hall grand, building peaceful.
But notice this, no cattle or sheep, no chickens or dogs. It's quiet, maybe too quiet. The text suggests it's just post-harvest leisure time for farmers.
Maybe, but still feels a bit staged.
So Wukong and Sandy catch up. Sandy naturally asks Tripitaka if he got thrown off.
And Tripitaka's still annoyed with Wukong.
A little bit, yeah. Calls him that mischievous monkey again. He startled the horse, like he could stay on.
And Wukong just blames Pigsy.
Of course. Quick as ever, it was all Pigsy, saying the horse was too slow. So I made him hurry up.
Well, poor Pigsy's dragging himself up the path, right?
Totally exhausted.
Nice.
Panting heavily, muttering about his aching back and how unfair it is being rushed around after carrying that heavy load.
The group dynamics are just perfect. So Tripitaka sees the state and suggests asking for lodging.
He does. Disciples look over there, a big house. We can ask to stay the night.
And this is the crucial part, Wukong's reaction. What does he see?
He sees something the others don't. Suspicious clouds, a propitious haze covering the place. He knows what this means.
Buddhas, immortals, some kind of divine presence.
Exactly. It's a clear sign. But, and this is key, he doesn't say anything.
He keeps it to himself.
Yep. Just agrees easily. Good. Let's go ask for lodging.
Ooh, okay. That's suspicious. Given the chapter title, Four Sages Test the Mind of Zen.
Right. His secrecy, combined with the auspicious signs he recognized, it heavily implies this isn't just a random farmhouse. They're walking into something. Probably a test. Okay, so the group arrives at this new place. What's the immediate vibe? What hits them first?
Oh, it's the richness, the opulence, right away. The text actually spends some time describing this really impressive gatehouse.
Why?
You know, with details like hunyo, these carved things that look like drooping lotuses and elephant trunks, and gimo, which means like painted beams, carved pillars, fancy stuff.
So instantly signals money.
Big time. It's very clear this isn't just any old house.
And of course, Pigsy picks up on this straight away, doesn't he? Always thinking about his stomach, or comfort at least.
He really does. He apparently says something like, this isn't cute, basically, an excessively rich family. He's not subtle.
No surprises there.
Yeah.
But Tripitaka, he's always the cautious one, the proper monk. He tells them to hang back, right? Why not just knock?
Well, it really shows his character, you know? He's very aware they're monks, travelers. They need to be respectful, ask properly for lodging, not just barge in.
Avoid causing any trouble or suspicion.
Exactly. It underlines his commitment to doing things the right way, even when they must be exhausted from their journey.
So you can kind of picture the scene. Pigsy's probably leaning against a wall somewhere, already dreaming of dinner.
Problem.
Tripitaka sitting patiently on what? A stone drum, and Monkey and Sandy are just sort of waiting by the steps.
Keeping watch. Bit of a standoff, waiting for someone to appear.
And who breaks first? Huh. No prizes for guessing it's Monkey. Sun Wukong. He gets fed up waiting. Nobody comes out, so.
Impatience kicks in.
His defining trait, really. He decides, right, I'm going to peek inside the gate.
Okay, so the nosy one takes initiative. What does he find in there? Does it match the fancy gatehouse?
It does. He sees this main hall facing south. Three big rooms, curtains are up. There's a screen with a painting.
What kind of painting?
It's a longevity and happiness as vast as the East Sea and Southern Mountain. Very traditional, very auspicious. Wishing for long life and all that.
Classic. Anything else?
Yeah, there's also this spring couplet written on red paper. It says,
Willow catkins drift like silk near the flat bridge at dusk. While snow-like plum blossoms dot the small courtyard in spring, it gives this refined, almost literary feel to the place.
Interesting. So it's wealthy, but also cultured.
Seems that way. And the furniture backs up the wealth part, definitely. There's a black lacquer incense table, a bronze incense burner, armchairs, seasonal screens. It looks like a place set up for comfort, maybe for receiving guests properly.
Right. But the quiet doesn't last, does it? Someone finally shows up.
Yes. Footsteps from a back door. And then this woman appears. The description is great. Sort of half old, not old.
Cryptic. What does that suggest? Ageless?
Mm-hmm.
Or just hard to place?
Maybe a bit of both. It creates this immediate sense of intrigue. And her first words, they're not exactly welcome, weary travelers.
No, what does she say?
She asks, who are you people just walking into my widow's home like this? It sounds a bit accusatory, but maybe also a little playful, flirtatious even. It's an odd opening.
It's a strange tone. How does Monkey handle that? Does he get defensive?
Surprisingly, no. He's actually very polite. Explains who they are, pilgrims heading west for scriptures, very respectful.
And that changes her tune.
Instantly, she smiles, welcomes them, invites them in, and then the text just pauses to describe her in incredible detail. It's clearly important.
Okay, let's hear it. What's she wearing?
Right, so she has this a woven gold, official-looking green silk jacket. Over that, a light red sleeveless jacket, like a vest.
Sounds expensive already.
Oh, yeah, and a colorful goose yellow embroidered skirt. High-soled flower shoes, quite fashionable, apparently, a sign of status.
So dressed to impress.
Definitely. Her hair's done up, too. A fashionable black gauze hairnet over coiled hair, which is described as being two different colors.
Two colors, huh?
Yeah. And she's got accessories, an ivory comb with red and green bits, two red-gold hairpins stuck in diagonally. Even her hair, which is slightly graying, is styled like flying phoenix wings. Pearl earrings, too.
Wow. That's a lot of detail. It's painting a very specific picture.
It really is. And the final line about her appearance is key, meaning she's beautiful even without makeup and has a charm like she's still young.
So despite being half old, she's striking, vibrant.
Exactly. And you can just imagine Pigsy.
Eyes popping out of his head, probably.
You bet. But okay, despite this very noticeable appearance, she acts the part of the gracious hostess, leads them into the hall.
And then what? Formalities?
Yep. Proper greetings, and then tea is served. This whole little ceremony unfolds. A young servant girl comes in, described with her hair in buns, carrying a gold tray with a white jade cup.
Even the servants and serveware sound high class.
Totally. The tea's fragrant and warm. There are exotic fruits served alongside. And even the way the servant moves is noted graceful. Her sleeves swirl, her fingers are slender like bamboo shoots as she serves them, and bows.
It's all very elegant, very refined. Establishes the household status beyond doubt.
Absolutely. And after the tea, the widow tells the servant to prepare a vegetarian meal, showing she understands they're monks. Seems like perfect hospitality.
Almost too perfect.
Well, it does seem like it's all leading up to something. Tripitaka seems to sense it too, perhaps.
Yeah.
He politely asks the widow her name and the name of this place.
Smart move. Get the basic info.
And she tells him they're in West Pole Continent. Her maiden name was Gia, married name Mo. Then she gives them the backstory.
The sob story.
A bit, yeah. Lost her parents-in-law early, then her husband died too. Left her alone, but with a massive inheritance. Basically, tons of cash, thousands of acres of prime land.
So a very, very wealthy widow.
Extremely. And she explains her situation. She has three daughters, no sons. Her husband's mourning period just ended. And she's got all this wealth and no male heir.
Okay, I think I see where this is going.
Yep. This leads right to the main event, her proposition. She says she wants to literally sit on the mountain and recruit husbands.
Recruit husbands? Plural.
Well, implying for herself and her daughters, and she looks right at Tripitaka and his three disciples and says, essentially, you guys would be perfect.
Whoa. Okay, that is direct. How does Tripitaka react to that bombshell?
He just shuts down. Completely. The text says he pretends to be deaf and mute, closes his eyes, calms his mind, and says absolutely nothing.
Just total silence. Well, not even a polite no thank you.
Nope. Stone cold silence.
Well,
it's a powerful rejection without saying a word. Speaks volumes about his shock or maybe his resolve.
You'd think that might be enough, but is she put off?
Not easily, it seems. She doesn't take the hint. Instead, she starts laying out the details of just how good they could have it. Really turns up the temptation.
Okay, let's hear the specifics. What's actually on offer?
It's staggering, honestly. She lists over 300 acres of paddy fields, another 300 plus of dry farmland, another 300 plus of orchards and forests.
Just the land alone is immense.
And that's just the start. Over 1,000 yellow water buffalo, loads of mules, horses, pigs, sheep, 60 or 70 different estates and pastures spread out all over.
Good grief. That's like a small kingdom's worth of resources.
Pretty much. And then the supplies. Enough rice and grain stored up to last them 8 or 9 years. Enough silk and satin for more than 10 years. And gold and silver. More than they could ever spend in their lifetime.
Okay, that's serious temptation.
Yeah.
Especially compared to their life on the road.
The text explicitly makes that comparison, contrasting this with the Dun, the toil and hardship of their journey west. It's wealth, comfort, security, yeah. Everything they don't have.
And Tripitaka. Still silent.
Still silent. Like a stone Buddha. So the widow tries a different angle. She gets more personal.
How so?
She gives her age 45, mentions her husband was a bit older. Then she introduces the daughters by name and age. Zen Zen is 20, Ai Ai is 18, and Lianalian is 16. All unmarried, of course.
Putting names and faces to the offer, almost.
Exactly. And she plays a bit modest about herself, calling herself plain, but makes sure to say her daughters are beautiful and talented, good at needlework, crafts.
The usual accomplishments for young ladies back then.
Right. But then she adds an interesting detail. Because she didn't have sons, she sort of raised them like sons. Educated them, taught them Confucian texts, even poetry.
Oh, so they're not just pretty faces, they're educated too.
That's the implication. Mm. She says they aren't, you know, overly vulgar despite living out in the mountains, basically arguing they're refined enough for these holy travelers.
She's covering all the bases, trying to make the offer irresistible.
She really is. Then she just lays it out again. Stay here, forget the pilgrimage, let your monk's hair grow out, become the masters of this household, enjoy all this luxury instead of your current life. Your simple
bowl and robes, your rough shoes and hat.
Yeah, swap the hard spiritual path for a life of unbelievable ease and pleasure. It's the ultimate worldly temptation, gift wrapped.
It's an incredible moment. It's a direct appeal to comfort, security, companionship.
Very fundamental human desires, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's designed to be tempting.
So how does Tripitaka react?
Oh, it's like she threw cold water on him. The text says he's utterly shocked, just bewildered.
You can almost see him recoiling, can't you?
Yeah. It's like the very idea is offensive to him. His commitment to the vows, to the journey west, it's so absolute that this suggestion is just unthinkable.
He sees it as completely against his purpose, right? No interest whatsoever in worldly pleasures.
None. And what's really telling is how he immediately shuts down Pigsy. Because Pigsy shows a flicker of interest, maybe.
Just a flicker. We'll get to Pigsy. But Tripitaka's rebuke is instant and strong.
Leaves no doubt. Even thinking about it is a betrayal of their mission.
That immediate, almost gut reaction from Tripitaka, it really shows how deep his discipline goes, doesn't it? It's not just rules for him.
No, it's his core identity. His entire reason for being on this path. It's like you said, suggesting a fish live on land. It's just absurd to him.
Okay, so after that flat rejection, things get even more interesting. The widow tries poetry.
Right, a poetic debate almost.
Yeah.
She recites this verse praising the lay life. You know, the comforts, seasonal clothes, good food, wine, the warmth of home.
Painting a picture of constant enjoyment, good company, marriage, and directly comparing it favorably to the hardships they face as monks.
It's a beautifully described vision of earthly contentment. It really speaks to those tangible joys, the appeal of being settled and comfortable.
But Tripitaka is ready. He comes right back with his own poem.
And his is all about the higher purpose. Renouncing those very attachments she praises.
Focusing on inner peace, the ultimate goal of enlightenment, escaping the cycle of desire and decay.
He contrasts her vision of temporary earthly pleasures with the internal reward of the spiritual path. It really lays bare the core conflict here.
That clash of worldviews is so stark in those poems. What strikes you most about the difference?
It's that focus on transcendence in Tripitaka's poem. Valuing inner liberation over any external comfort. It's a direct challenge to her whole value system, which is rooted in the material world, in sensory pleasure. Fundamentally different ideas of a good life.
You'd think that would be the end of it, right? He's made his point pretty clearly.
You would think, but she's persistent. She actually gets quite indignant. angry even at his rejection and his claim that the monastic life is superior.
And then she pivots. Okay, if you won't stay, Master, how about one of your disciples? I'll take one of them as a son-in-law.
Which is a clever move, isn't it?
Definitely. What do you think is behind that? Is it just trying another angle, or is there more to it?
I think it's both. Maybe genuine persistence, but it's also a test of the group's unity. Can she pick one off? Exploit any lingering desires among the disciples.
Okay, let's look at those disciples. Monkey first. His reaction.
Classic monkey. Immediate refusal, dripping with sarcasm.
Yeah.
Claims he knows nothing about, you know, marriage and settling down.
And then he immediately throws Pigsy under the bus.
Hilariously, yes. Suggests Pigsy is much more suited for this kind of thing. Far more experienced.
What does that sarcasm tell you? Monkey knows what's going on, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He sees Pigsy squirming. He uses that sarcasm to cut through any pretense. He's got zero interest himself, and he's clearly amused by Pigsy's internal battle.
Ah, Pigsy, now we get to him. His struggle is almost physical, isn't it?
You can practically feel it. He's restless, shifting about. He even tries to get Tripitaka to just pretend to be interested.
Just play along for a bit so they can get some food, a roof over their heads.
Exactly. His immediate practical needs are right there at the forefront. Food, shelter.
And you can see him wrestling with the idea. Giving up being a monk, getting married again, that comfortable life. He really is that battleground between spirit and flesh, isn't he?
He embodies it perfectly. That focus on the immediate food, comfort, it shows how powerful those basic drives are, how easily they can overshadow bigger goals. It's relatable, honestly.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Sandy. Yeah. How does he react?
Sandy is the complete opposite of Pigsy here. Rock solid.
Unwavering.
Totally. He expresses deep gratitude to Tripitaka for even taking him on as a disciple in the first place, rescuing him.
Right, it feels indebted.
Deeply. And he flatly rejects the offer. Wealth, marriage, nope. He's committed to the journey, committed to his master, full stop.
That quiet determination from Sandy really stands out here, especially next to Pigsy's turmoil.
It shows how far he's come. Remember his past. Being given this chance on the pilgrimage means everything to him, and he's not throwing it away. He sees the value in this path.
So after all three disciples essentially say no, Monkey sarcastically, Pigsy reluctantly but overruled, and Sandy firmly what happens with the widow.
The mood just snaps. That apparent kindness vanishes.
Instantly.
She slams the doors, locks him up tight, leaves him standing outside. No food, no shelter, nothing.
Wow, that's a harsh turnaround. What does that sudden shift tell us about this whole encounter? Was the kindness ever real?
Probably not. It reinforces that title, doesn't it? Four sages test the mind of Zen. This was almost certainly a setup, a test orchestrated by bodhisattvas or some higher power.
A trial disguised as temptation.
Exactly. Showing that the path isn't easy, and even nice-seeming situations can hide challenges.
So they're locked out, and then the discussion among the disciples starts Pigsy, predictably.
Starts complaining immediately.
Of course he does. Blames Tripitaka for being too blunt, too rigid.
Moaning about the missed opportunity, the comfort, the food, the pretty daughters.
And Monkey naturally can't resist winding him up further.
Oh, he dives right in. Starts teasing Pigsy about becoming an inverted door son-in-law.
Meaning he'd live with the wife's family, right?
Right. Monkey paints this picture of how cushy it would be financially. And hey, maybe they could all get a feast out of it if Pigsy married in.
And he twists the knife by bringing up Pigsy's last marriage, doesn't he? At the Gao family farm.
Ouch. Yeah, he reminds everyone of Pigsy's track record. It's teasing, but it's pointed. It forces Pigsy to confront his own patterns.
What does Pigsy say back? Does he just take it?
He gets defensive. Tries that classic line, oh, everyone feels this way. All monks secretly want this. They just hide it better than me.
The universalization defense. It's not just me.
Exactly. Then he quickly pivots to practicalities again. What about the horse? It needs feeding. There's no food here.
Trying to change the subject, maybe. Distract from his own embarrassment.
Seems likely, yeah. It might be a genuine concern, but the timing is convenient.
And then what does he do?
He decides, quite abruptly, to take the horse out to find some grass. Practical action. Or is it?
Because Monkey immediately gets suspicious.
Instantly.
Yeah.
Given Pigsy's moaning and his track record, Monkey doesn't trust him.
Why? What does Monkey think he's going to do? Just graze the horse?
Probably not. Monkey likely suspects Pigsy might try and sneak back to the house, try his luck again, maybe find a way into that comfortable life he was just denied. Pigsy's impulses are strong. Old Pigsy. He practically leaps at the idea. marrying into this family. He is so on board. It's almost comical.
It really is. So much so that Sean Monk even pipes up, doesn't he?
He does. He says something like, second brother, didn't you? Used to have a wife. Just a little gentle reminder of his past life.
And that's key, isn't it? His past. It keeps cropping up, this tension between his spiritual aims and these very earthly, very human desires he still carries.
It's his whole struggle, really. Makes him relatable, though.
And funny, like when he immediately offers to deal with the horses.
Oh, right. Hang on. Let old Pigsy go graze the horses.
Yeah, graze the horses.
Like he's suddenly passionate about equine care. It's so obvious what he's really after.
It's wonderfully transparent, isn't it? The excuse is so thin, we try to do that sometimes, right? Dress up our less noble desires as something practical.
Guilty as charged. So, okay, he goes out supposedly to the horses, but really heads towards the back gate.
And lo and behold.
There they are, the mother and the three daughters, just, you know, casually admiring chrysanthemums.
Yeah, tranquil scene. And the mother, she doesn't beat around the bush, does she?
Not at all. She basically says to him, look, your master's being a bit fussy, isn't he? Wouldn't settling down here marrying one of my daughters be, like, way better than being a wandering monk heading west?
It's a very pragmatic viewpoint, you know, stability, family, versus this uncertain, difficult quest. It taps into really basic human values.
And Baji, well, he launches right into his pitch. He knows he's not exactly conventionally attractive.
A slight understatement, perhaps.
Yeah. But he goes, okay, maybe I'm ugly, but I'm useful. And then he starts listing his boastful skills list.
Oh, the list is fantastic.
Isn't it? He's like, got 1,000 acres, no problem, don't need an ox, one swing of my rake, boom, seed sown, need rain, I gotcha, need wind, done, house too small, I'll add a few floors.
It's this amazing mix of, like, farm work and actual magic. He can summon rain and wind.
And he says, I can sweep, I can unclog drains, basically any household chore, I can handle it. I can kick heaven and stir the earth.
He's really selling himself hard there. It's hilarious because, you know, he's still a monk, technically. And the sheer bravado. It's part practical skills, part maybe wishful thinking.
Total wishful thinking. It's like the most over-the-top CV ever. But the mother, she seems kind of impressed.
A little bit, yeah. She says something like,
Okay, if you're really that handy, maybe go talk to your master. If he's cool with it, maybe we can make this work.
And Baji's response, just golden.
No, perfect. He's like, talk to him. That. He's not my dad. It's my life, my decision.
Priorities, right. The immediate temptation just wipes everything else out. Forget the master. Forget the quest. Hello, potential wives.
Exactly. Yeah. Meanwhile, Sun Wukong's been watching all this, hasn't he? Or at least sensing the vibe.
Oh, yeah. He knows Baji. He knows something's up. He's the perceptive one.
So what does he do? Transforms into a little red dragonfly to spy on him. Discreetly.
Classic Wukong move. Always observing, always a step ahead.
Yeah.
But the Tang monk actually tells him to go easy, right?
Yeah, bless him. The monk says, Wukong, okay, go look, but try not to tease him too much.
Famous last words, maybe. Knowing Wukong.
Huh. Probably. Wukong agrees, but you know there's mischief brewing.
He's gathering intel. You just know he's going to use this later.
Yeah.
Probably for maximum comedic effect.
Oh, for sure. And when he returns, he can't help but chuckle as he recounts Pigsy's desperate eagerness to accept the widow's offer. You can just picture the knowing look on his face, sharing the gossip with Tripitaka.
His amusement really highlights Pigsy's lack of spiritual discipline and his persistent susceptibility to worldly temptations. It provides a moment of, well, levity in what could be a tense situation.
But the test is far from over. So, okay, Baji thinks he's got the mother's okay, sort of. And then comes the grand entrance.
Yes. The big reveal.
The mother brings out the three daughters. The inner gate opens, and the widow reappears with her three beautiful daughters, Zen Zen, Ai Ai, and Lian Lian.
Ah, the daughters finally appear.
The scene is described with such vivid detail. Lanterns casting a soft glow, fragrant incense filling the air, and the daughters themselves are breathtakingly beautiful.
Wow. That's pretty over the top, isn't it? Designed to impress.
Totally. Delicate eyebrows, radiant complexions, beauty that could topple nations, all that stuff. Floral hairpins, embroidered sashes, smiles like cherry blossoms, fragrance of orchids and musk.
Pearls and jade trembling in their hair, finer than any famed beauties.
Yeah.
Like goddesses descended from heaven.
Exactly. It's laying it on thick, really emphasizing the temptation.
And you can imagine how this hits someone like Zhu Baji, who's already halfway there in his mind, especially after he just called himself ugly.
Oh, yeah. And the reactions from the others? Priceless.
Tell us, what do they do?
Okay, so Tang Monk immediately looks down, starts praying, pure piety.
Okay, Sternberg.
Sun Wukong pretends he hasn't noticed a thing. Total feigned indifference.
Playing it cool, or maybe just enjoying the show.
Shamunk. He actually turns his back, like, nope, not looking, avoiding temptation.
Disciplined.
Yeah.
Sensible, maybe.
And Zhu Baji, our pigsy.
Let me guess.
Staring.
More ruling.
Pretty much. The text says his eyes remained fixed, his lustful thoughts were in complete turmoil, his desires utterly unrestrained.
Sounds about right.
He even blurts out something awkward, like, oh, thanks for coming down, celestial maidens. Mother maybe asked the sisters to come closer.
Oh, Baji. Smooth.
So smooth. But these reactions, they show everything, don't they? Monk's devotion, Wukong's detachment, Sha Monk's avoidance. Well, Baji being Baji.
It's a perfect snapshot of their individual struggles right there.
Then the mother asks if anyone wants to marry her youngest. And who speaks up? Sha Monk. And he sounds totally serious. He says, actually, we've already discussed it. We decided that the one named Zhu, he'll marry into your family.
No way. Is he being serious or is he just trying to, like, manage the situation, get Baji sorted?
Hard to tell. Maybe a bit of both. But Baji suddenly gets cold feet. He's like, whoa, whoa, brother, don't set me up. We need to talk about this properly.
Huh? He wanted it, but now it's real. He's backtracking.
Looks like it. But Sun Wukong jumps in. He's not letting this go.
Oh, here we go.
Wukong basically takes charge, sets up a whole mock ceremony on the spot. Okay, master, you're the groom's dad. Mother, you're the bride's mom. I'll be the matchmaker. Shuk Monk, you're the go-between.
He's totally railroading it.
Completely. No need for lucky days. Today's perfect. Yeah. Pigsy, come on, bow to the master. Then get in there and be the son-in-law.
Wukong the trickster, just having a field day with this, exploiting Baji's own weakness. It's kind of mean, but also funny.
Baji's just spluttering. No, no, this won't work. I can't do this.
Feeble protests. Too late now.
Way too late. Wukong's practically pushing him towards the mother, making them bow. And the mother just rolls with it. She tells her staff, right, set the table. Big dinner tonight for our new in-laws. I'll take my new son-in-law to his room.
Pigsy, following this woman, who he thinks is his future mother-in-law, deep into her home.
Right, and the description in the original text is quite vivid, isn't it? Something about layer upon layer of rooms.
Yeah, yeah. Pusta, like, you just don't know how many rooms. And he's bumping and stumbling along. It paints quite a picture.
It really does. A huge, maybe even a bit chaotic place.
You get that sense immediately. And Pigsy himself complains, doesn't he? He asks her to slow down because he doesn't know the way.
Yeah. Mother, walk a bit slower. And her reply just lists off more rooms they haven't even passed yet. Storerooms, kitchens.
It really drives home the scale of it all, which leads Pigsy to exclaim, wow, what a grand household.
So what does this huge house tell us, do you think, beyond just being big?
Well, I think it immediately sets up this feeling of abundance, maybe even excess.
Okay.
And for Pigsy, who's, let's be honest, often driven by his appetites, This grand setting probably makes the whole marriage idea even more appealing. It sort of primes him, maybe makes him more susceptible to, well, what comes next?
Interesting point. So then we get to the proposal itself, and it's surprisingly informal.
Very much so. The mother says, look, it's an auspicious day your master picked, but it was also sudden, you know. So no time to arrange a proper ceremony.
Right. No bowing to heaven and earth, none of the usual rituals. Her idea is just 8 bows upwards.
Which, of course, leads Pigsy to his wonderfully practical suggestion.
Oh, yes. Classic Pigsy.
He basically says, look, mother, you sit down, I'll do a few bows, and we'll call it the wedding and the thank you. 2 birds, 1 stone.
Oh, wouldn't that be convenient?
Exactly. Yeah. And the mother just laughs and agrees, calling him a convenient and capable son-in-law.
It just perfectly captures his mix of self-interest and maybe a kind of rough practicality.
Definitely. No time for frills when there's a marriage to be had, apparently.
It really shows his priorities, doesn't it? Just get it done. But then things take another turn when he asks which daughter he's marrying.
Ah, yes. The mother's dilemma.
Right. She puts on this act, pretending she's worried about jealousy. If I give you the eldest, the second might be upset.
If I give you the second, the third might be upset. If I give you the third...
The eldest might be upset. So she's stuck, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And Pigsy's solution to this delicate family problem...
is just audacious.
Completely. Mother, if you're worried they'll fight, just give them all to me.
All of them. Just like that.
To
save uproar, and keep the family rules in order.
And his justification is priceless. Basically, doesn't everyone have three or four concubines?
I mean, wow. That says a lot about his view of the world, or at least what he wishes the world was like.
It really does. It shines a light on, well, maybe the social norms, or perhaps just Pigsy's very unique interpretation of them. It's certainly not about romance.
Not even slightly. It feels very transactional. More is better. Acquire the wives.
Yeah. And the mother's reaction initially is what you'd expect. Kamisoro. Nonsense.
Yeah.
You can't possibly take all three. But Pigsy doesn't miss a beat, does he? He boasts about his, what was it?
Exactly. His techniques of endurance in battle. Implying he is more than equipped to handle three wives and keep everyone happy.
It's such a revealing moment, applying his warrior mindset to, well, to marriage. That same sort of blunt confidence.
Or perhaps overconfidence. It really sets the scene for the next part, this bizarre idea from the mother.
The heavenly marriage. Okay, so she suggests Pigsy basically plays blind man's bluff for a wife.
Pretty much. Put this handkerchief over your head. And we'll have a colliding with heaven marriage.
She'll have the daughters walk past and he just grabs one. Whoever he manages to catch.
It's quite something. What do you make of that?
Well, it's certainly clever on her part. It seems random. Takes the decision out of her hands, supposedly.
Right. And it plays right into Pigsy's eagerness, his lack of, you know, thinking things through. But you feel like it's just another layer of the game.
Absolutely. And the text even throws in that little poem, doesn't it?
It does. Two ends, foolish and ignorant, not seeing the real reason.
Achio. The sword of lust wounds the body in secret. It's like a direct commentary.
Yeah. Hooroo. Hooroo. Today, the new groom covers his head. It's basically telling you, the listener, look how foolish this guy is, blinded by desire.
No subtlety there. So Pigsy's blindfolded, ready to grab a bride, and the scene sounds quite alluring.
Oh, definitely. You get the jingling jade pendants and the oozy fragrance of orchids and musk. It sounds like fairies are floating around, creating this dreamlike atmosphere. But Pigsy's attempts are anything but graceful.
Not at all. The description is pure slapstick, lunging wildly left and right.
Eek. Can't catch anything.
Just women moving back and forth, apparently countless, which is, but can't grab a single one.
He ends up denipping, crashing to pillars, gloping walls, running around dizzy, just falling over. You can just picture it.
Total chaos. And he gets so frustrated, complaining the daughters are too clever, too slippery.
Which leads to the mother's absolutely perfect deadpan explanation.
Oh, it's brilliant. He, she says, is not that my daughters are slippery.
They were just all being so modest and polite, none of them wanted to be the one you caught.
The irony is just dripping off that line, isn't it? It really underscores how easily he's fooled because he wants to be.
Exactly. He can't see past his own nose or his own desires. Have you ever seen that in real life? People just interpreting things exactly how they want them to be?
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly human, isn't it? We filter reality through our wishes sometimes. And Pigsy, well, he takes it to another level in his desperation.
He makes perhaps the most outrageous suggestion yet.
He really does.
He pleads.
Since they won't marry me. How about you marry me instead?
Just. Wow. Aiming for the mother-in-law herself.
And her response is just perfect. That mix of mock shock and deflection.
Good son-in-law.
Such lack of propriety. You even want your mother-in-law? She shuts him down, but cleverly.
Which smoothly leads into the second test, the final hurdle.
The pearl-inlaid silk shirts.
Right. She says each daughter made one, and the deal is he can marry whichever daughter's shirt fits him.
Simple enough on the surface.
Yeah.
And Big Z, ever the optimist, ever ready for more.
Jumps right in. That's good. Good.
Bring all three. Let me try them all on.
If they all fit, I'll marry all of them.
He just never learns, does he? His enthusiasm is almost endearing in a completely foolish way.
It really is. Of course, though, she only brings out one shirt.
Only one. And the big reveal, it's not quite the glorious fitting Pigsy hoped for.
No. He tries to put it on, but before he can even do up the belt, he just trips and falls flat. Because It turns out the shirt is basically bound tight with ropes.
So not exactly designed for comfort. or wearing.
Not at all. It feels like the final, very physical punchline, doesn't it?
It really does. Mm. A literal binding, maybe symbolizing how he's trapped by his own foolishness.
That's a great way to put it. He can't fit into this situation because it was never real, and he's too tied up in his own desires to see it.
And poof, just like that, the women are gone, vanished, leaving Pigsy there, probably sore and definitely confused.
The illusion just evaporates.
The next morning, the travelers awaken to a very different reality. The grand estate has vanished, and they find themselves back in the familiar pine forest where they had initially stopped for the night.
Just like that, back where they started.
Tripitaka is understandably shocked, but Sandy immediately recognizes that they had encountered spirits in disguise. He puts two and two together.
The return to their original location emphasizes that the luxurious estate was never real, but a carefully constructed illusion designed specifically for this test, a magical stage set.
Monkey King, of course, understands perfectly what has transpired. He explains that the seemingly wealthy family was a manifestation of Bodhisattvas, sent to test their resolve.
Ah, the big reveal.
And then they discover a revealing note hanging from an old cypress tree.
A message from the testers. The note provides the definitive explanation of the entire encounter, leaving no room for doubt about the true nature and purpose of their experience.
The note is an 8-line poem that reveals the true identities of their testers. The revered Mother Li Shan, along with the Bodhisattvas Guanyin, Manjusri, and Samantabhadra, all in disguise as the mother and daughters.
Wow, the heavy hitters of the Buddhist pantheon.
Exactly. It clearly states the purpose of the test. To highlight Triptaka's unwavering devotion and Pigsy's significant lack of spiritual discipline and persistent worldly desires.
So a performance review, basically.
Pretty much. The final lines urge them to purify their minds and remain diligent on their journey. A pretty direct spiritual assessment.
The poem serves as a concise evaluation of each traveler's spiritual progress and provides a valuable lesson for them to carry forward on their path. Do better, Pigsy.
And speaking of Pigsy, they then hear his cries for help echoing from deeper within the woods.
Still tied up.
He is still bound by those magical ropes. Tripitaka, displaying his inherent compassion, pleads with Monkey King to rescue Pigsy. And Monkey King leads Tripitaka to find the still-bound Pigsy.
He's been tied up.
Tied up.
And he's hanging from a tree, literally suspended there.
Oh, Baji. You can just picture it. The big guy just dangling.
It's the immediate fallout from failing that test the night before. The illusion vanished, but the consequences. Very real.
And I bet Sun Wukong has something to say about this.
Oh, does he ever? Wukong sees him and just starts laying into him, teasing him mercilessly, calling him good son-in-law.
Oh, harsh. Rubbing salt in the wound about the illusory marriage proposal.
Exactly. Asking why he isn't thanking his new in-laws for stringing him up.
You can imagine how mortified Baji must be. Just hanging there, completely shamed.
He's so ashamed. The text says he can barely speak. He just kind of mumbles. Wukong's really enjoying it, of course.
But someone helps him down, right?
Yes, thankfully. It's Sandy.
Always the kind one.
He can't stand seeing Baji like that, even if he did bring it on himself. So Sha Seng climbs up and unties him. It's a nice moment of, you know, camaraderie despite the circumstances.
And how does Baji react once he's back on solid ground? Is he just mad or?
No, actually, he seems genuinely remorseful. The story makes a point of saying he kowtows repeatedly.
Kowtows. So, like, bowing his head to the ground.
Yeah, a really strong gesture of apology and deep shame in that context. He really seems to feel terrible about his behavior during the test.
Well, that's something, I guess. It shows he can recognize when he messes up.
Right. And his remorse kind of leads into the next big takeaway, the explicit moral lesson. It comes in another poem.
Another poem.
Roughly, lust is a sword that wounds the body. Greed will surely lead to disaster. Pretty blunt.
Wow, yeah. No mincing words there. A direct hit on what got Baji into trouble.
Absolutely. It's a stark warning about how unchecked desires, both lust and greed, can really harm you, lead you straight into disaster, just like the poem says.
It also mentions something about preserving your capital, right? What's that about?
Yeah, it talks about guarding your binkin, which you can think of as your inner resources, your virtue, your discipline, your spiritual energy.
Ah, okay. So giving in to temptation is like spending that capital foolishly, draining your account.
Exactly. You're squandering something valuable. The poem stresses needing to basically hold firm, guard that inner strength. Don't let yourself become dissolute or undisciplined.
And does Baji seem to take this message to heart? after the kowtowing and everything.
It appears so. He makes a vow right then and there.
What does he promise?
He promises to reform, to basically clean up his act, and to diligently follow Tang Monk on the journey, no matter how tough it gets. He sounds sincere.
Tang Monk.
Tang Monk, being the compassionate figure he is, accepts Baji's repentance. He sees the shame, hears the vow.
And forgives him.
Seems like it. He allows Baji to rejoin them properly, and the group continues on their way west.